This is not my first time at the Perimeter Institute, but it's embarrassingly close to it. I mean, if it's so close, if it's so close to Toronto, then I wish I'd been able to arrange to come more often. Excuse me. I just caught a quotation on the web page. The future will bring surprises we can't predict. Perimeter will be one of the places they hatch. Leonard Susskind, Stanford University. Well, that certainly seems reasonable to me. But just this morning, concrete way, I ran into that because it took me 15 minutes. And I got within 100 meters of the Perimeter Institute. It then took me 100 meters. It took me 15 minutes to get closer because of the last minute construction. I don't think that was on Google. It's not always nice to see proof of something, concrete proof of something. But obviously the Perimeter Institute is one of the great institutions in science. One more just general comment. I'm starting to regret that I complained about the mention of the Unitil case in the last lecture, because it might have very well have been in that lecture that it was the least interesting case, but in my lecture the Unitil case will be the for practical purposes, again concrete purposes, it'll be the most interesting case. The Unitil case is the only case so far where one can say anything in terms of classification. Roughly speaking, and on the other hand, so I'll just make a general statement first. Actually, it's a bit like it reminds. The comparison is it's not fair, but I mean it's not a reasonable comparison. But when I was a graduate student, Irving Kaplansky came to the University of Toronto and gave a colloquium, and at the beginning of the lecture, he said, "Well, the first 5 minutes is going to be very simple, and anyone, I hope that everyone will follow it 100%, and then the rest of the lecture will be less important. It'll just be an application of the first 5 minutes, and in fact, that's what exactly turned out to be. I mean, I can't say that I can still remember the first 5 minutes, but I definitely remember being very happy about it. And then the rest of it, well, we could just see it was supporting it was showing that the very abstract, simple, general theorem he introduced in the first 5 minutes was just something that was not just of interest for its own sake, intrinsic identity. It did have resonance with other things that people had been working on. Well, all right, but my first 5 minutes is going to be just I've already had 10 minutes, but what would have been my first 5 minutes is going to be just stating in general terms a certain theorem, classification theorem, I won't say in exact detail what's being classified, and I won't say in exact detail what the statement of classification means. But it just seems to me that The recent progress over the last years, it's decades and then it's years and then it's months and then it's the last minute progress has come in hours and minutes, but it's I got the preprint yesterday, I guess, from the which is tied up the whole thing in an important case. So So I can talk about the classification of simple separable. This is metric space separable. Unital. And this is not because the non-unital case is necessarily different. I mean, different in terms of the results. But that's interesting. The Fields Institute blackboard goes down. You hope that the non-unital case. You hope that you don't need the unital assumption. Okay, simple separable unital C star algebra. Now separable means if you're going to be classifying something. Even if you want to just classify sets, you can't classify all sets. I mean that's at least there's cardinal numbers, but certainly large cardinals get quite complicated, and large C-star algebras, non-separable ones, get much more complicated than the separable ones. Even if it's you're talking about approximately finite dimensional C-star algebras, definitely separable, unital for technical reasons. We can only do it for the techniques only work in the unital case so far. And simple because the invariance for the classification so far only really makes sense in the simple case. And by simple, of course, I mean for a C-star algebra. For simple, I mean if you look at consider it as an algebra, and well, if it's unital, then you can just consider it as an algebra and say it's a simple algebra. And that means there are no non-trivial two-sided ideals, no two-sided ideals of the algebra, which are proper and non-zero. So no non-trivial two-sided ideals. If it's not unital, then you have to just talk about closed ideals, because that's the interesting notion of simplicity is in terms of closed two-sided ideals. All right, but we're definitely working with unital.
George?
Yes.
Just in the interest of the first 5 minutes being understandable to everybody, so a lot of the people in the audience are physicists. I bet they would benefit from just the definition of what is an algebra and what is a C-star algebra.
Oh, okay. But these are associative algebras. Yeah. But maybe I'll postpone the notion of what a C-star algebra is. I mean, I'll postpone introducing it. I'll say something about it in a few minutes, but I just wanted to. Of course, I'm going wildly beyond the first 5 minutes in terms of time, so sooner or later, it's going to be time to say something about what the context actually is. But I just wanted to somehow close the loop, in the sense of actually stating some theorem, and you could just see from the syntax it was a theorem without knowing what the ingredients were. So if I've been talking about the definition so far, it's because I guess it's just somehow to get warmed up myself. No more definitions for about one more minute, and then maybe I'll make some definitions. So there is another property. There is another property which is also necessary. So I'll underline it. I won't expect you to know what it is because the definition is quite recent. I mean, within the last few years. With finite, what's called finite nuclear dimension. And by the way, this is the well-behaved in my in the title. This is the well-behaved, and if you just look at arbitrary animals, unital or not, well, even unital, but simple separable Sestra algebras, well, then there are just, for instance, if you look at the Sestra algebra coming from the free group, the regular representation of the free of a free group, then that's actually you can tell those apart, but it's nothing to do with the general classification theory. No, definitely, you have to talk about well behaved, but think of this as just a black box at the moment. So this is the category of algebras. Is this a title or a theorem? Well, I'll just say holds. Classification holds. And there's the theorem. and what are the invariants? Well, it turns out the invariants are the only invariants, roughly speaking, you can have for a Sestra algebra. If it's some... one way to see that is if you look at the commutative case, then if you have if you look at smooth functions on a manifold, then you have all kinds of you have all kinds of things. The cyclic cohomology, for instance, has a lot of structure, a lot of information. But if you look at the Sestra algebra, then the cyclic cohomology is just the measures on the space. Of course, that's enough to determine the space, so that's not very not a very good example. But if you look at non-complete subalgebras, so you have a Sestra algebra, and then you look at things which are smooth with respect to some derivation or something, then there'll be lots of invariants that don't exist for the Sestra algebra. But if you look at invariants for the Sestra algebra, then they're relatively few. So roughly speaking, K theory is the invariant. Okay, so that's more or less the statement of the theorem, and the question is what is the context where what is the context where Sestra algebras arise, and why is that interesting? How does it relate to the rest of mathematics? Well, it turns out that Sestra algebras rise naturally in quite a few ways. Now certainly the subalgebras, the dense subalgebras of the algebra arise also, like the smooth functions as opposed to just the continuous functions. From the point of view of topology, I think that people would agree that it's natural to look at the continuous functions on a topological space. And if you're looking at algebras of operators in a Hilbert space, so what's a Sestra algebra? Well, there are concrete Sestra algebras and abstract ones, and it's really the same thing, just like concrete categories and abstract categories. If the category is a set, then it's a concrete category, even if you don't see it as one. It's a concrete category. It's a It's a category where the objects are sets instead of just objects, and then the sets have some structure. They have operations, some kind of structure, and then the maps in the category are not just formal arrows. They are actual set maps between the sets, which preserve the operations. So that's a concrete category, and an abstract category is just where you have a whole lot of points and arrows, and you can compose some arrows, and it's associative. And you can compose arrows if they match up. Well, okay, so what's a concrete and an abstract Sestier algebra, and why are they exactly the same thing? Well, in the category setting, it's the theorem of Yoneda that a small category is always concrete. Well, what's a concrete Sestier algebra? You look at a Hilbert space and look at the algebra B of H of bounded operators. And this is the grandfather Sestier algebra. So what's the structure? A Sestier algebra is a typical mathematical structure in the sense of Bourbaki, or nowadays anybody. It's a set, and it has operations. It's like a vector space. Well, it's a vector space, and then it has multiplications. And algebra is a vector space where you have multiplication, of course. And either the multiplication is either associative, in which case you say associative algebra, or it's non-associative, in which case you say non-associative algebra. Except as in the last lecture, you then want to look at particular kinds of non-associative algebras. Well, I suppose you want to look at particular kinds of associative algebras too. Since the Hilbert space is in a certain sense its own dual, you can talk about, it makes sense to talk about self-adjoint bounded operator. And more generally, it makes sense to talk about the adjoint of any operator. And if you have a set of operators, then you can say that the subset is self-adjoint if for any operator in the set, the adjoint isn't also in the set. I'm using the mathematician's notation for the adjoint. For matrices, if H is finite dimensional, then you're talking about matrices. If you fix an orthonormal basis, then the adjoint operation is just given by taking the complex conjugate of the matrix. Sorry, the complex conjugate, and then the conjugate transpose. You take the conjugate transpose, and you might say, well, if you have an operator and you express it in terms of a matrix in the basis, and you take the conjugate transpose, well, and that defines an operator. But why is that independent of the basis? Well, it just happens that it is. The reason that the question arises is if you talk about the transpose, then that you can't talk about the transpose of an operator. You can only talk about the transpose of a matrix. And also the complex conjugate. You can't talk about if it's a complex Hilbert space. You try to define the complex conjugate of an operator by saying choose an orthonormal basis and look at the matrix and take the complex conjugate of the entries, and then look at the operator that you get. That operator depends on the orthonormal basis. But if you do both those things, it's almost like PCT spin and statistics. You have to do all three PCT. But here, if you do two things, if you take the transpose and the complex conjugate, then it's conserved. It's independent of the basis. All right. So that means that just the abstract algebra is a star algebra in a natural way, and that's where the star comes from. This star, it's a slightly perhaps slightly confusing terminology, because this star doesn't refer to the dual space. It's using the fact that H and H star, if you like, are anti-isomorphic. H star is isomorphic to the opposite Hilbert space, if you like, just because of the fact that every continuous linear functional in a Hilbert space has a very special form. It comes from an actual vector in the Hilbert space. But if it's a complex Hilbert space, then you multiply the vector by, if you look at the inner product on the functionals, then in the case of a real Hilbert space, then they're just isomorphic. The dual space and the Hilbert space are isomorphic. But all right, so we have in the real or complex case, we have a star algebra. But let's stick. I want to stick with the complex case because that's for some reason that's simpler. Partly because of the fundamental theorem of algebra, but much more than that. This is the granddaddy C star algebra, concrete C star algebra. And then if you look at this a subset of it, which is a sub-algebra, closed under, it's a sub-vector space, it's closed under addition and scalar multiplication. And if it's closed under multiplication, then you say it's a sub-algebra. And if it's closed under the adjoint operation, then you call it a sub-star algebra, if you like. Now what does C mean? Well, I don't really know what C means, but you could imagine it means closed. So the sub-algebras which are closed in the topology. So it should be closed in all possible senses that you can imagine, except in the weak operator topology. Then you're talking about special star algebras, which are called Feynman algebras. And you can't separate off the theory of Feynman algebras from C-star algebras. In fact, that comes into the proof of the classification theorem. You can't do anything about C-star algebras without talking about Feynman algebras. And it's the converse is also almost true. But I'm talking about C-star algebras, so it's norm closed. It's closed in the norm. And when I said the C-star algebra was separable, I meant if you have a norm vector space, then it has a metric coming from the norm. You look at the norm of the difference of two vectors, and that's a metric. And if you say it's separable in that metric, that's what you mean, separable for a C-star algebra, because in particular, it's a norm vector space. That's the notion of a concrete C-star algebra. And an abstract C-star algebra, well, that's just a polished version of the concrete one. These are concrete objects. You might want to say, let's just consider it as a star algebra, an abstract star algebra, and put additional axioms on a star abstract star algebra. I mean, it's easy to, you could say abstract algebra with a star operation. It's easy to say what the axioms are for a star algebra. But when you start putting in the norm and then saying what axioms you should have for the norm star algebra, then that takes some work. And you might say, what's the purpose of worrying about the axioms? Why do you care that this collection of concrete star algebras, the norm closed subalgebras of the algebra of all bounded operators on a Hilbert space, why do you worry about an abstract description or characterization of those star algebras? Well, that's for one thing, it's history. I mean, just someone, Gelfand and Imark, just did it. But why did they want to do it? Well, in fact, suppose it just seems to be necessary to work with the concrete ones. I mean, even if you didn't care about axiomatics, and you wanted just to prove things about concrete C-star algebras, then, for instance, the simplest thing about a concrete algebra, if A is the concrete C-star algebra, and you have a closed two-sided ideal. So, of course, these ones don't, the simple ones don't. But suppose you do have a closed two-sided ideal, and then you look at the quotient algebra. Well, if A is a concrete C-star algebra, then that means it lives on a certain Hilbert space, but the quotient algebra is not obviously operators on any Hilbert space at all. So it's easy to give it a norm. I mean, any quotient of a Banach space by a closed subspace has a norm to make it a Banach space. And the star operation passes to the quotient. I mean, it's easy to prove that an ideal is necessarily invariant under the star operation. So the quotient is a star algebra, but how do you know it's a C-star algebra? Well, it's not a concrete one in any obvious sense. You have to use the axiom of choice to prove it's a concrete one in general. Even if you're looking at B of H, suppose this is B of H, and you look at the ideal of just compact operators. You look at the ideal compact operators, and you look at the quotient, then this is a star algebra. It's also a C-star algebra, but the Hilbert space is, if the given Hilbert space is separable, the Hilbert space that this acts on is non-separable. And the only way you get it is by using the Gelfand-Neimark theorem. That an abstract C-star algebra, it's not hard to prove. This does satisfy the Gelfand-Neimark axioms. This class of star algebras is invariant under natural operations. That's why you introduce the abstract notion. But also, it's convenient for stating the theorem too. It means you don't. It's easier just to have a hot air type statement of the theorem. You don't have to talk about Hilbert spaces. You just say, suppose we have a simple separable unital C-star algebra, and it has this. By the way, this is a very abstract property too. It just says that look at the identity map on the algebra, then it factors through finite dimensional. It factors in a certain way through finite dimensional algebras. But I won't go into the details of the. I won't go into the details of this factorization. It's a certain well-behaved. Condition. By the way, there are other ways of stating this property. It turns out that this is such a natural condition, and so why do you call it well-behaved? Maybe there are many other ways of being well-behaved, and they're all different. In which case, it would be wouldn't be fair to say that this particular property is what well-behaved means. Well, it turns out, and this is a theorem which is part of the classification theorem too, but it's been a conjecture parallel to that for a while, and it's not completely, because it's much more the general idea is that the notion of being a well-behaved C-star algebra is a very robust notion. No matter how you say it, it's always give the same answer. That's a throwaway comment. I'm not going to go into that, but I used the term well-behaved advisedly in the sense that no matter how you define it, it's going to turn out to be the same, and that's almost part of the theorem. But if you like, then let me give it a very special. This is a very particular property. And it involves a very particular kind of approximate factorization of the identity map in terms of very important maps, not in terms of homomorphisms, not in terms of C-star algebra homomorphisms, but in terms of maps which are are positive maps, and they have certain quite special properties. Actually, they are homomorphisms. If you look at a C-star algebra, and you take the tensor product with. If you take the cone over the algebra, take the cone over the algebra. In other words, continuous functions from the open interval 0, 1. The half open interval 0, 1 into the algebra, with the which will vanish at zero. Or will vanish at infinity, if you like. Or the, if you look at that algebra, and you look at homomorphisms of that into a C-star algebra B, then then that's the kind of map that you that's the kind of maps that you use in factorization, roughly speaking. So it's almost it's a factorization almost in terms of homomorphisms. If it were exactly in terms of homomorphisms, then that would say the nuclear dimension was zero, and that's the same as saying that it's that the algebra is an approximately finite dimensional C-star algebra. For instance, like what's sometimes called the fermion algebra. If you take the infinite tensor product of 2x2 matrix algebras, well, this is not the definition of the fermion algebra, but by the Jordan Wigner theorem, the fermion algebra is isomorphic to infinite, the C-star algebra infinite tensor product of 2x2 matrix algebras. And these are all finite. These are all the finite tensor products are finite dimensional, finite linear dimension. Of course, they're just matrix algebras. But the and then the limit of the increasing union of these finite tensor products. That is a simple example of a simple separable unital C-star algebra, and the. How people first got the idea that C-star algebras maybe ought to be classifiable is that these ones could be classified. These were classified, I mean, if you put, instead of two, you put some other numbers, and you look at infinite tensor products, then these were classified by Glim. This was, I mean, I guess Glim is as well known as a mathematical physicist as a mathematician, and also as an applied mathematician. But he started off working in C-star algebras, and his PhD thesis was classifying the infinite tensor products of matrix algebras of various orders. And then Bradley went on from that and just looked at increasing sequences of finite dimensional algebras. And he showed that these were really quite well behaved. I mean, they in the generic sense. I'm somehow using well behaved here as a semi technical use of the word. I'm using it to mean that it's a robust subclass of the class of all algebras with a whole lot of properties which seem to be coalescing to be the same property. But what Bradley noticed was that AF algebras are very nice, if you like, and were already interesting enough he suggested they might be even typical of general C-star algebras, and that's turned out to be the case, and that was prophetic in the sense that the classification which he proposed and I reformulated in terms of K-theory for these algebras, these so-called AF algebras. So a finite number of points here means that each of these algebras is a finite direct sum of full matrix algebras, which is the same as saying that they're finite dimensional as linear spaces. If a C-star algebra is finite dimensional as a vector space, then it's either a single full matrix algebra or a finite direct sum of them. Of course, these three dots are different from these three dots, which is indicate that you're taking a limit. An infinite sequence, then you take the limit. Well, okay, so there are some examples. There's a definition of C-star algebras, and some explanation of why you want both an abstract definition as well as a concrete one. But why are C-star algebras, but you know, just the fact that Glim spent 5 years studying C-star algebras as a pure mathematician, and then 5 years, at least 5 years studying C-star algebras as a mathematical physicist, that seems to me that's already a good indication that that C-star algebras are interesting. I mean, if you want an ad hominem definition, I mean, argument, ad hominem argument, then just the fact that, I mean, when Glim got the Presidential Medal of Science, I think I looked it up, and his C-star algebra work is one of the things mentioned in the citation. Well, from a mathematical point of view, one justification for a subject is that just that it can be just that it has some intrinsic depth and interest, intrinsic interest. And I think if you have a theorem like this, that the very simple invariant, this is just algebraic K0 and then Banach algebra K1. And and then you look at traces as well. In the AF case, you don't have to look at traces. But and then this, the K0 group has a certain, the K1 group is just a group, abelian countable abelian group. And the K0 group is an ordered group, sometimes called a partially ordered group. And you can, well-behaved cases, you can say exactly what the values of what ordered groups arise. And how does the classification help? I mean, after all, if you just look at countable abelian groups, just look at this K1 group as an invariant. That's an arbitrary countable for this class of objects. This particular invariant takes on it is a countable abelian group. I'm concentrating on K1 because that's the simplest part of the invariant. In fact, just to support that statement, if you look at the case of the AF algebras, it's the K1 group is zero. Of course, that's not sufficient for it to be approximately finite dimensional. But anyway, the K1 is an arbitrary countable abelian group, and so my point is that these are quite no one knows how to classify countable abelian groups. So I mean, if it were a divisible countable abelian group, then it would be a rational vector space. And then it would either be finite dimensional as a vector space over the rationals, or be infinite dimensional, and then that would be the end of it. I mean, and it can, and of course those cases are included. But if you take an arbitrary subgroup of a finite dimensional rational vector space, then it's the classification is wild. The point is that these things are somehow simpler objects. They're simpler objects, even if you still can't classify them. So if you look at the functor, if you like, from this class of algebras. Just let me finish this diagram. This is my trademark diagram for the classification. You go from abstract. This is just some category. In this case, it's the C-star algebras in question, well-behaved C-star algebras. You go from there to the invariant, and. Why am I drawing this as a smaller circle? The reason is that this C-star algebras have many, many automorphisms because they're non-commutative, so they have lots of inner automorphisms. But if you look at countable abelian groups, there are almost no automorphisms at all. Okay, so if it happens to be a rational vector space, then there are automorphisms. But generically, I guess if you can find a way to make it precise, I guess generically for accountable viewing group, there are absolutely no automorphisms whatsoever except for the identity map and then the reversing the sign, multiplying the element by minus one. That's an automorphism. But otherwise, no, this is the simplest possible category. Even if you look at that part of it, this is the simplest possible kind of category you can imagine. The only isomorphisms are just really simple. Okay, well, that's my attempt to. So I should just say very quickly what the name. I mean, this is supposed to be a theorem, and it's posted under the names of Gong. My co-authors are Gong, Lin, and Niu. But this is a relatively short paper. This is a 20-page paper based on many earlier papers. In particular, a 300-page paper by these three authors, and then it's followed by a 50-page paper, which removes one of the axioms. So this one had additional axiom, and that happened with the Sestra algebra characterization too. Gelfand and Imark had lots of axioms, and over the last 100 years, or well, 1943 to now, it's not quite 100 years, but actually it's more or less my age. I should be acting my age, I guess. But okay, so I guess that means I should stop. But the axioms here did get cut down quite a lot. It's just as they have here. Well, thank you.
I suppose in the interest of time, perhaps, do we have time for one question? One quick question.
You didn't say exactly what, I might have missed it. So the restriction to unidal came in as important where?
Yeah, okay, that's a good point, because it's not clear at all from what I've said how it comes in technically. But that shows how completely separate non-technical my lecture has been. But as soon as you, if I were going to prove anything at all, if I were going to prove any of these things at all about not about the general theory, but about the because the Gelfand-Neimark theory applies to arbitrary Sestra algebras, but if I were going to prove anything at all about these simple separable unital well-behaved algebras, well, I'd just have to have a work with a unit. Now, why? Well, it's all kinds of reasons. There's one thing which is, it's the point is you need to have a. It's like if you have if you're having visitors and you have and your house is not as tidy as you might like, and so you'd like to clean it up before the visitors come, and then that means you have to take a lot of things and put them in a cupboard. Well, a cupboard has to have a door. And the unit means the unit says that you're going to have other projections too, other idempotent elements too, and the idempotent is the door. You're going to when you tidy things up, you're going to be putting things inside the cupboard, and it should be a small cupboard, or they'll start asking questions. That's the rough idea.
Okay. So we're going to shift gears now. The subsequent talks are more physics talks, except for maybe Masood's, which is more going to be another with more pure mathematical flavor, which reminds me of another announcement, which is that schedule swap where Masood and Laurent used to be scheduled to speak last, but he just came back from Europe and where there's a risk he'll fall asleep before his talk, so we're going to move him into Masood's talk. Masood's spot, Masood will speak last, so Laurent will be at 3:15. And there will be cookies downstairs. I just have to go grab them from my office and a coffee from the coffee machine, and we'll meet back here at 11:35.
We just thank George all the time.